Evidence and Answers begins right now.
Many critics claim the Exodus is just a myth, pointing out that there are no Egyptian records of Israel, the plagues, or Pharaoh's defeat. But Egyptian rulers never recorded humiliating defeats, and their histories were carefully crafted to portray themselves as godlike. So how can archaeology reveal the truth? Dr. Stephen Collins shows that with the right date and the right pharaoh, the evidence strongly supports the Exodus as a real historical event. You're tuned to Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Today, we will be concluding Message 3 in Evidence and Answers 2025 conference series. Now, with the conclusion to Pharaoh of the Exodus, is Dr. Stephen Collins.
But Amenhotep II is a thug, by his own admission. He had a composite bow built so strong that he says, I'm the only one that can pull my bow. Nobody else can pull my bow. And you have his mummy. He's the widest of all the mummies of the 18th dynasty. He's a hulking guy. And he's a tough guy. He's a thug. He takes his army and he goes north. He puts a parallel flotilla coming up the Mediterranean. He's going up there to Syria to find all of these kings. He picks seven of them. That's what he says. Seven Syrian kings who have fomented rebellion against him. He finds them. He captures them. He takes them all to the coast, ties them to the prow of his ship, keeps them alive, fed and watered, all the way down to Thebes, to Luxor, gives them, puts them in confinement, feeds them well, plumps them up, gives them back on a day of celebration, gives them back their regalia, their royal regalia. And he brings them one by one into the temple at Luxor. And personally, Amenhotep II, by his own hand with his own sickle sword, lops off one at a time, lops the head off of every one of them. This is the king. He didn't hire an executioner. He did it personally. King before me, whop, seven times. Next one, whop, has their bodies cut into little pieces, has little cuneiform tablets in Akkadian so they'd understand it, written and tied to those body parts, and he has these distributed all over the Asiatic territories. The little tablet says, this is what happens when you mess with Amenhotep II. Guess how many rebellions he had for the rest of the 18th dynasty. They remembered that and nobody messed with them. So that pretty much ended all of that. Well, all good things come to an end. And then we have this guy, Thutmose IV. Now remember, up to now, every time the Egyptians poked their army into the northern Levant, they had to butt heads with the Mitannis. And Thutmose IV looked at this situation, and for the first time, we have a diplomatic thought in the mind of an Egyptian king. He thought, wait a minute, this costs us a lot of money to keep this thing going. Why don't we just make a deal with the Mitannis? We'll send them a bunch of gold, and they can send me a princess, and we'll all be happy family, and they can recognize our border at the Euphrates River, and as their brother, partner in the covenant, we'll give them total access to the Mediterranean like they want. Win-win. That's what he did. However, Egypt had been negotiating for about 100 years with both Mitanni and the Hittites. Who would they sign a treaty with? The Hittites wanted that northern Levantine area, but they couldn't get it because of Mitanni. Hittites were hoping they could sign a treaty with the Egyptians, which would lock Mitanni out and give the Hittites access to the Mediterranean trade. What just happened? Thutmose IV sided with Mitanni and cut the Hittites out. Before that ink was dry on that treaty, the Hittites were now the sworn enemy of Egypt. And they were seething, and Supiluliuma, by the king, the great warrior king of the Hittites, remember that name, Supiluliuma, best dog name ever, right? She called him Soupy. Soupy Luliuma was bound and determined someday, to take by force what they've taken from me. And so we have the Mitanni, Egypto-Mitannian alliance. So everything's all huggy-kissy between Mitanni and the Egyptians. And now between the power of Mitanni and the combined power of Egypt, Hittites are high and dry and angry. Well, number one power in is Egypt. Number two power is Mitanni. Number three power is the Hittites. And we still have that arrangement going on. And this is the first international alliance Egypt ever made. That's why Redford and others and Reeves, Egyptologists, have called Thutmose IV the greatest pharaoh in the history of Egypt, arguably. Now, he's not as great, powerful, and lengthy a reign as Thutmose III, his grandfather, but he's the first one to do a brilliant maneuver to keep from having to fight all the time and spend all the money up in the northern territories. So everything is great. Everything is wonderful, except one thing. All good things come to an end, right? For some reason, Thutmose IV died young. We only have documentation for year 8, nothing higher. So most, like Kenneth Kitchen and others, give him 8 to 10 years. That's all. But we have his mummy. In fact, he's the best identified of all the 18th dynasty mummies. He's young, between 25 and 30 years of age. He's handsome, well-coiffed, beautiful manicure. He's got big rings in his ears. Healthy, no pathogens, no wounds on the body. Young, healthy, good-looking, dead. When you're dead, all those other things really don't matter a whole lot. So there he is, dead. Why is he dead? Well, let's look what happened after that. When he died, his son, Amenhotep III, was only 12 years old. Pop didn't live very long. And I want to show you what happened. As soon as we get into the reign of Amenhotep III, the very next pharaoh, who's number one? Hatti. Mitanni has slipped to number two. Egypt is now third. Wait a minute. What just happened? Amenhotep III withdrew all the troops from Syria and Canaan. He let the Asiatic territories go. The empire evaporated almost overnight. It had become a custom through many generations now for Egypt to control this territory, and all of a sudden, he let it go. And what we say is, he would have controlled it if he could have controlled it, but he couldn't, so he let it go. And why couldn't he? We'll come back to that. Something happened after the death of his father that Amenhotep couldn't control. And by the way, Amenhotep III was 12 years old and didn't want to be pharaoh, had no idea about being pharaoh, didn't want to. And who ruled for the first half of his reign? Who really administered Egypt? His mama. Queen Mutamwiya, remember the Mitanni princess that T4 took in that negotiation? That's his mother. His mother, Mutamwiya, who's Indo-European Mitanni, rules Egypt for about half of his reign. And when she dies, his wife, A3's wife, Queen Tia, rules for almost for the rest of his reign. And what he does, he moves his palace to across the river, actually to the valley of the king's side of the river, which is really weird. And he builds his palace and he builds a big lake out in front of his palace and he builds a party bark, right? And so he spends most of his reign spending money building monuments to himself because Egypt had lots of money. The Nubian gold never dried up. And so he could do that, but he's partying. So he's having a party out on the lake. By the way, any Star Wars fans? In Star Wars, there's a perfect character that is a dead ringer for Amenhotep III. Jabba the Hutt. Got him? That's Amenhotep III, just hanging out on his barge, you know, having a party. And so what's happening? Egypt is dying from plagues. It's being disrupted. They've lost their northern empire completely. And he's just trying to stiff upper lip, build lots of stuff. Oh, yeah, we're fine. Oh, we're good. Yeah, But it wasn't good. It wasn't good. Egypt is collapsing around his ears, and he knows it. 38 years, he rules for a long time, 38 years. But during that 38 years, here's what happened. Watch this. During the reign of Amenhotep III, remember Mitanni and Egypt were linked, controlling the whole area? During the reign of Amenhotep III, Supiluliuma, remember him? Supiluliuma took his Hittite army, crossed the Euphrates River, and crushed and burned Washukani, the Mitanni capital, to the ground. Whoa. And he did it with impunity, without any fear of Egyptian reprisal whatsoever. He now was going to take by force what he had been refused by having a treaty with Egypt, and he was angry, and he destroys the Mitanni capital, and Mitanni is reduced to a vestige of its former self. And by the way, 20 years from right now, from this, Supi's going to return, and he's going to wipe it out, all of it, going to run it into the ground. Now, what do the Hittites have? Now the Hittites have what they always wanted. They've got control of the northern Levantine coast, and they have entered the Mediterranean economic world. And they are happy, happy people. Now, Supiluliuma is not interested in the southern half of the Levant. He couldn't care less about Canaan. Let the Egyptians have it if they want it. I don't care. I want what I want, and that's the Mediterranean access coastal areas. So he's got it now. With Mitanni now taken down, Assyria now is right. Remember, they were a vassal state. Now Assyria is rising, and they are quickly going to become the old Assyrian Empire. And of course, they're going to wind up butting heads with Mitanni, but that's off our story. And so this is the situation. Now look at this. This is still in the reign of Amenhotep III. Hatti is number one. Assyria is number two. Egypt might be number three. And Mitanni's hanging on by a fingernail. And they're about to be wiped out completely. So here we are. Now we're in the time of Akhenaten. If Thutmose IV is Pharaoh of the Exodus, Joshua's conquest of Canaan would start in the second year of Akhenaten, 40 years later. And as we'll see, the Amarna texts, which talk about the Habiru disrupting cities and towns in Canaan, exactly what Joshua was doing, are written during that period of time. So it's amazing there. Now, we got a couple of guys coming in. After Akhenaten dies, then we have a couple of pharaohs within 2 years. I mean, it's so disrupted that we really can't tell much what's going on. But then this guy comes along. You ever heard of him? Tutankhamun, King Tut, the famous King Tut, who's been all over the world touring with all of his stuff, right? And so here he is. But he dies young. Boy king dies young, no children. Now, this is going to be the strangest thing. Remember, Egypt has lost its empire since after the death of Thutmose IV. Amenhotep III didn't do anything to regain it, and Akhenaten is completely powerless. Egypt is continuing to collapse. All scholars know that the plagues that have been in Egypt for a generation and a half are still there. Still there. So Egypt is about ready to die. But when he dies, when King Tut dies, he has no children, his little wifey, God's wife, her name is Ankh-Esen-Amun. This is the weirdest thing I can ever find in the history of Egypt. This is really, really weird stuff. Remember, this is Egypt. Nobody conquers Egypt. Nobody messes with Egypt. They're so far away from everybody, and nobody cares, really. And so, but now we have the wife of the dead King Tut writing a letter to Supiluliuma, the great warrior king of the Hittites. The Hittites are the sworn enemy of Egypt. She's writing a letter to the enemy king of the Hittites. And here's what she said. Let me quote the letter. Dear Supi. Okay, I made that up. Dear Supi, my husband has died. And by the way, why is her letter important? Because in Egypt, always, It is the wife, the God's wife of the Pharaoh that just died. She is the one who will legitimize the throne of the next Pharaoh. If she has no daughters, then the next Pharaoh has to marry her. Thankfully, hopefully it's not your mother, right? But if she has a daughter, then that will solidify. So you have to marry either the next Pharaoh has to marry either the God's wife or the daughter of the God's wife. That legitimizes your throne. So she has the power to do what she says she can do. She says, "Dear Supi, my husband has died. We have no sons. I hear you have many sons. If you will send one of your sons to be my husband, I shall make him the Pharaoh of Egypt." What? Egypt? The queen of Egypt is offering her kingdom to Supiluliuma as a vassal state. "I'll become your vassal. Just save me." Because Egypt is in a bad state of affairs. It's about ready to go toast. So she writes him. Now, Supiluliuma gets the letter. We have it in the Hittite archives. And Mersili, too, his son, records the reaction of his father upon the reception of this letter. He's storming through the palace, pounding himself with his fists on his forehead, going, "What are they trying to pull? Nothing like this has ever happened in my whole life. I mean, who offers you like a whole major kingdom like for free? What's happening here?" So he gets his envoys together and he says, "Go to Egypt and check this out. Go on. This can't be real." So the envoy goes down to Egypt. And by the way, what's going on to Egypt still? Still plagues, disease. They go down to Egypt. Guess what they catch? They don't know it, but they contract this, the bug. Okay. And so they're down there and they get an audience with Queen Ankhesenamun. And they ask her, is this real? And she gets really angry. She says, "Yes." And she writes a letter to Supiluliuma. The second letter, we have that too. Starts out like this. I said, and she quotes the previous letter. "My husband has died. We have no sons. Send me your son." And so his envoys come back to Hattusis, and they say to Supiluliuma, "Man, it's the real deal. Egypt is hurting and they're bad. She's offering you Egypt on a gold platter. I mean, here it is. Take it." So he says, okay, line my sons up. So he has a whole bunch of sons, right? He goes, Kind of reminds me of Samuel and the sons of Jesse, right? You got any more sons? None of these guys. So he's going through, No, not you. And I think he picks the one that's the most irritating, rebellious son that he's got, right? It's like, "Yeah, Zidanza, you're gone. Z, you're out of here." So off he goes. And so the whole envoy takes Zidanza, marches him down to Egypt, and then the plot thickens. This make a great movie. So the plot thickens. As soon as the envoy and Zidanza starts to cross the border into Egypt, he's assassinated. So now Zidanza, the son of Supiluliuma, is dead. Well, now the word gets back to Supiluliuma. What do you think he's going to do? He already knows by all this reconnoitering that Egypt can't do anything about. If he attacks Egypt, they're not going to do anything. He can take it by force. So he's already controlling all that land down to the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. He just says, "Get my troops together. We're marching on Egypt. We're going to take Egypt by force." And so he gets everything ready to march. But guess what? They can't march. Why? Because they've contracted the plagues from Egypt. They're sick. They can't march. Isn't it interesting? If the very plagues that God put on Egypt that caused Pharaoh to say, "Get out of Dodge, you know, I'm letting your people go," go. The same plagues that brought Pharaoh down are the same plagues that's now going to save Egypt's neck from the Hittites. That's kind of an irony, isn't it? So they can't march, and on and on. Well, all those stories are fun, and then Horemheb comes along, and he hates Akhenaten, and he hates King Tut, who he works for, and I'm just going to go out here and get past all of this. But the bottom line is, the biblical events that happened around the time of the Exodus would have caused a dynastic collapse. And in that whole, remember, 200-year spread that's been suggested for the time of the Exodus, how many dynastic collapses happened within that entire stretch of time? One. Look for the collapse, and you've got your Exodus Pharaoh. All right, here they are. It makes perfect sense that the decline and collapse of the 18th dynasty as a result of those five core events, I call them the five core events of the Exodus story, that it would have brought about collapse. And here they are. I knew they were going to come up someday. 10 plagues, like one thing. Plundering of wealth. Remember, they plundered the Egyptians, gold and silver and cloth. Loss of labor. Oh, Egypt, just in the Exodus, Egypt lost a massive labor force. Loss of military. Remember, in this, they drowned. The Egyptians only had one army, really. The northern army of Amun-Ra. And they drowned. They lost their military. Not only that, they lost Pharaoh. The Bible's very clear that Pharaoh died in the sea. He didn't get to come back like in the movie. He died in the... Well, see, and people say, well, wait a minute. If Pharaoh died in the Yam Suf, in the sea, with his troops, how do we have his mummy? And the answer to that question is very simple. If you're going to do biblical archaeology, read the Bible. If you read the text, it says, the next morning after that event, after heaven, all the bodies of the Egyptians washed up on the shore. The Egyptians would have drowned 1,000 slaves going after the drowned body of their Pharaoh. Why? Because if you don't bury the Pharaoh properly according to the Egyptian Book of the Dead and go through all the procedures and removal of the organs and all of that stuff and, you know, turning them into beef jerky and all that stuff, if you don't go through that, then bad things happened to Egypt. It was a religious thing. It was a thing that they firmly believed. So they got his body. They took him back to Egypt. They prepped him. And there he is, young, handsome, healthy, and dead. That's our Pharaoh. Well, when you consider that there's only one dynastic collapse during the 18th and 19th dynasties until way late in the 19th dynasty, which is almost down to, through the Iron Age, here it is. I'm going to go this real fast. First Pharaoh of the 18th dynasty. This is our power rankings of Pharaoh and how much control they have over the empire. Little bit, a lot. Tutmosis III is going to come in here. And then Amenhotep II, Tutmosis III. But now watch what happens. Boom, boom, boom. They lost the empire. That's the dynastic collapse. If you put the Exodus right there in the events, it explains that precipitous decline and collapse of the 18th dynasty. It went away. That's it. By the way, watch this. This is even more dramatic. Look at this. In the time of Tutmosis IV, Egypt is number one. Mitanni is number two. Hittites are number three. Syria is number four. Watch what happens in that shift of that one pharaoh. One pharaoh. Look at that. The whole international scene changed. Now Hatti's number one. Assyria's number two. Egypt is number three. And Mitanni's wiped off the face of the earth. What just happened? The Exodus just happened. That's it. Well, there it is. You'd predict it, and the guy that's responsible for that upon his death, and I'm not going to go through all these quotes. These are quotes from other scholars. I like them. But they're basically saying, hey, just confirming all of this. By the way, all these quotes come from a book called The Five Views of the Exodus. And these scholars are arguing back and forth, and they're all making my point. So I call the book The Five Erroneous Views of the Exodus. And they need to put the right one in there. All right, there they are. Now, Joshua then comes into the land to conquer in the second year of Akhenaten. But anyway, there it is. The history is clean and clear. The Exodus occurred. And this is how we get the Bible and archaeology going together. The Bible and the archaeology can talk, can't they? Scholars were never able to explain the colossal collapse of the 18th dynasty. Seemed to be no reason for it whatsoever, except there were some plagues, but they never put two and two together. But when we let the Bible talk and the archaeology and the Bible talk together, all of a sudden we have a perfect reason. We have a cause and effect relationship between Near East history and biblical history, and the events of the Exodus caused the collapse of the great and mighty 18th Egyptian dynasty.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586. Or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.